by the Sahaba. So it was something for certain circumstances. And in brief, when a student goes, for example, for study abroad for 3-4 years and needs some sort of, the natural urges to be fulfilled, he cannot go for permanent marriage. So they try to do this.
There's no difference between permanent and temporary marriage except for the time and dowry. Allah, the Most Gracious, the Most Merciful, gave all the decision-making for marriage into the lady's authority. And if her guardian tries to ban her from marrying someone who's good and honest, they don't have the right to do this, especially if she's older and wise enough to take care of herself. The contract is never complete without her permission.
But this wasn't the only issue which offended so many. What really bothered the many critics was the BBC linking Iraq's highest religious authorities, including Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali al-Sistani, to sexual exploitation. Beloved by millions of Muslims worldwide and accredited with saving Iraq from terrorism, for Iraqis, seeing Sayyid Sistani questioned alongside low-ranking criminals went down badly with viewers.
It's very offensive. It's completely unacceptable. And that is why we wrote to the BBC and we highlighted that such association is completely unjustifiable and can never be accepted at all. Here is a man who has worked tirelessly to ensure that the rights of women are indeed looked after. And he himself has issued a number of instructions and decrees for the protection and preservation of the of women. And he condemned such practices as well. You know, when he was asked by the BBC itself, he issued a statement which said this is unacceptable.
During my travels, I headed down to the holy city of Karbala in southern Iraq. Karbala is one of the holiest places for Shia Muslims, with millions visiting its grand mosques every year to pay their respects to the Prophet's grandson Imam Hussein, who was martyred at this location 1,300 years ago.
What an amazing place. Just take a look at the background. Whether you're Sunni or Shia, you're going to love the architecture and the beauty of this grand mosque. Regardless of which sect you belong to, this place is beautiful.
The BBC came here too and spoke with Sheikh Ahmad Al-Asadi to see if the Ataba organisation, which administers the holy sites, condoned the practice.
They came to us to ask about our locations for marriage services and our procedures and services. During the conversation, we discussed mutter marriage. But when you look at the finished BBC programme, it focuses on illegal sexual businesses. From what they showed when they came to Ataba, they wanted to send a message to the world that Islam insults women, an issue which the West has actually, treating women as objects of lust for money. For us, marriage is a holy process. The BBC has no right to bring what the West believes about women and apply it to us.
Despite providing the BBC with detailed answers to their questions, Sheikh Al-Asadi's talk was edited down to an astonishing 28 seconds in the entire one-hour programme.
The ones who interviewed us were not honest. They didn't transfer anything we discussed. The interview lasted 35 minutes, but they were not professional and they didn't use most of what we discussed. They transferred just what they wanted and left the rest behind. The BBC treated us without justice or in a professional way. They treated us like an intelligence agency would treat an interrogation suspect. The Ataba was targeted in this program after Grand Ayatollah Sistani's fatwa to fight Daesh. They wanted to knock down the Ataba and show a black image about us.
The BBC clearly wasn't making any friends, but was the documentary trying to mislead people about Iraq?
after speaking to the same individual that the BBC spoke to here inside the Ataba, it is very clear that there is a degree of resentment towards the BBC for the type of filming that they did here. Obviously, this was an important subject which needed to be highlighted, but the problem is the BBC appears to have launched a character assassination campaign against the most senior figures here in Iraq, including the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali al-Sistani. Following our talk, I decided to look into what these scholars are up to myself. In particular, the work spearheaded by the organisations associated with the Holy Mosques.
So, just one of the many things which the organisation has set up to help deal with the people's needs is hospitals. In particular, since the outbreak of the coronavirus, this of course has been vitally needed as the government in Iraq hasn't been able to fulfil the needs of the people, especially during a global pandemic which nobody anticipated would arrive.
I visited schools, hospitals, orphanages, universities and charities, including ones that assist women who had lost loved ones during the horrific war against Daesh. None of this was shown by the BBC.
We have two projects with UN support. The first is related to helping Iraqi women, including the young who receive abuse in society. The second helps to protect refugees from the wars who may have been abused too.
With so many discrepancies already being discovered, I wanted to find out what else the BBC had conveniently forgotten to mention. Back in London, I got in touch with Iraqi activists who had been rigorously researching the BBC's claims and findings. Due to fear of repercussions for their work, we have chosen to protect their identity. What they found was stunning.
We found more than 73 mistranslations within the documentary. One single documentary by one of the largest media corporations in the world. 73 mistranslations. None of the individuals who are accused of misconduct in the documentary are linked in any way to the shrines. None of those individuals have committed any of those crimes inside the shrines or indeed with any cooperation with anyone from those shrines. The shrines and these criminals do not have any links, and yet the BBC were very clearly pushing this narrative to the audience that the shrines had something to do with this misconduct and this abuse and these crimes they were trying to report on. Again, shifting the focus away from the real criminals. What they have demonstrated is cowardice, or there seems to be a narrative they were following instead of the truth.
Many senior Muslim groups complained to the BBC following the documentary's release. However, the BBC's replies have been more than a little disappointing.
As a result of the investigation and the information we have gathered and the detailed analysis of the documentary, we started sharing our findings in a formal way to the BBC. We lodged a complaint to the BBC and said to them very clearly, laid down the details of the findings, including the mistranslation, including the factual errors they had, including the lack of balance and objectivity when they were representing information, including the way they failed the real victims by ignoring some really difficult areas. Areas of violence and abuse. But throughout the process, they were making corrections, to be fair to them. They were making corrections, of course, after millions had watched the erroneous mistake-filled version. But even after they were making these corrections, neither did they admit nor did they announce that they were making the correction. So they did it in a very subtle and sneaky way.
They denied responsibility, they denied liability, and they completely let their credibility and their professional responsibility down.
After the program went live, anger in the community spread rapidly. Action was taken, including a petition to cancel the documentary and coordinated press releases. And this indeed
Sheikh Mohammed Al-Hilli was one of the many prominent Muslim speakers who condemned the film as Islamophobic.
When you watch this particular documentary, is the an idea that somehow Shia Muslims are supportive of such practices, or at least they're silent about it. Of course, the other problem I had personally with the documentary is the lack of representation and the opportunity for scholars who are able to speak English, or at least from the Shia community, to present their opinion regarding what was going on.
Despite the information being provided to the BBC of their inaccuracies, no action was taken to correct the issues, despite the BBC's promises to do so. Another prominent voice of damnation came from Ayatollah Milani. Known and respected in both Iraq and the UK, he informed me that the BBC had an obsession with Muta going back years.
This is unfortunately not the first time that BBC does that. 5 years ago, they interviewed me about the temporary marriage. And in details, I explained the history of that and all the principles of that in a very clear way. I provided the presenter with a copy of my book, Islamic Family Law, where a chapter in that is discussing in details the whole idea and concept of temporary marriage. But unfortunately, when they produced it and it was broadcasted, I found that a lady was interviewed, and she said after my work and my interview that temporary marriage is like prostitute. And when they asked me, I mean the producer of this BBC video, when they asked me about my opinion and to interview me, I said, look, I have a very bad experience from the previous time.
All this was enough to upset Iraqis, but I noticed other issues yet unhighlighted.
The fact that the BBC continuously mentioned irrelevant points, such as the criminals claiming to be descended from the Holy Prophet Muhammad, combined with the journalist using her own personal views, such as claims that Sharia law grants fewer rights to women, adds that with the use of subliminal messaging, such as the constant use of mosques and holy sites throughout the entire programme, all appears to be aimed at convincing the audience that Islam is an oppressive religion. Now, that's very interesting, given the fact that the programme also failed to mention, even once throughout the entire hour-long documentary, the 2003 British-supported invasion and occupation of Iraq. Now, that is very interesting, given that the invasion totally destroyed the country, impoverished millions, and left so many vulnerable to criminal elements in society, particularly Iraqi women.
But would the BBC do all this knowingly? I spoke to one former BBC staff member to find out.
Can the BBC honestly claim that they are impartial?
One of the things that the BBC says when it's espousing its vision around the world, usually through the arm of BBC World Service, it's the idea that we are objective, we are impartial, and we are unbiased. These things cannot be true when you're dealing with the news. Sometimes there's a guilty party, sometimes there's an innocent party. Through omission, through a choice of whether or not to include a particular voice, to downplay a particular voice, or even the omission of a particular story, you're making it quite clear what side of the argument you're on. Now, when I worked for the corporation, like most of the journalists who were employed, I was there on a freelance basis. I was there as a presenter, as a producer in the London section. And you saw policy-making decisions. When I oversaw decisions being made, they were clearly done through a chain of command. So you couldn't just come up with a story and independently go and deal with it. You would have to go through an editor, through a producer, perhaps even through a line manager. Lawyers would check over your content from time to time. I mean, we'd even have the pronunciation department call you up and say, that's not quite how you say that name. Now, all of these things are being done for checks and balances, but they're also being done with one eye on, is this the kind of stuff we want to run? Is this the kind of stuff that will make us look bad? Does this represent core BBC value stuff?
Back in Kardemir, I decided that the only thing missing from my investigation was the criminals themselves. So before leaving Iraq, I decided to try and find those involved in abusing the Mutta practice.
Now, the way it was described at the time by the journalist reporting in the documentary was like she was almost entering into a red light district. It was a shady area which did questionable marriage services. But actually, on the contrary, there is a very family atmosphere here. This place is, you know, where people bring their children to come and visit one of Shia Islam's holiest sites. There are markets here, many shops, and Iraqi society is very conservative, so for anyone to be conducting practices which could be compared to prostitution openly in a place like this would certainly not be tolerated by the local community or by the authorities which patrol this area on a day-to-day 24-hour basis.
Speaking to locals, it became immediately clear that those exposed by the BBC had a poor reputation to begin with.
They just brought someone from the street. He is not educated in the religion. When you want to talk about anything, you need to bring a specialist.
It wasn't long before we found the brother of Raad, Rawad Al-Kabur. Raad was one of the men exposed by the BBC in their documentary. Rawad agreed to speak to us about the BBC and his brother's conduct.
My brother has no office or license. He's not authorized to do any marriage contract. These people, they just lied to say something bad about Raad and Islam. If I see anyone doing unlicensed mutter marriage, I would insult them and their great-grandfathers.
After attempting to defend his brother, we asked if he would bring us to Raad for further scrutiny. Raad, however, refused to show himself. We also failed to track down Sheikh Salawi, who was also filmed by the BBC. However, we were told by researchers that he was not a recognised scholar and didn't represent any mosque, Ataba or Sistani's office.
Our investigation took multiple dimensions. One of the dimensions was to go on the ground and identify those individuals. Who they are? Who do they represent? What qualifications do they have? Do they really exist? And that investigation very quickly uncovered that someone called Sayyid Raad was not a Sayyid. He has absolutely no qualification, no religious background, yet he was represented by the BBC as a cleric. We told them that, by the way, you haven't done your due diligence by looking after who these people are. But they denied that and said, no, we have done our due diligence. We asked to see evidence of that, but they failed to answer.
Documentary, in as far as presenting this, is not necessarily, we are not necessarily in any shape or form objecting to the presentation of this abuse. But we have to remember this, that in many war-torn countries, such abuse takes place. This is no justification. But it doesn't matter whether you're Shia, you're Sunni, you're Hindu, you're Jew, you're Christian. This kind of practice happens all around the world, and it's wrong, it's completely unacceptable. But to somehow continuously frame it to be a Shia thing, which the name of the documentary, which the documentary itself continuously sought to do, was something that, of course, we are completely unhappy with. And we voiced our concerns through legitimate means, through a very well presented and researched document which involved research in Iraq to go and speak to offices where somehow these rogue elements were working and issuing marriage certificates to young children and so on, where we've investigated how these people who are doing it have no relation whatsoever with the seminary, have no relation whatsoever with the clerical establishment, have no relation whatsoever with Ayatollah Sistani. They just happen to be criminals.
Now, of course, no one would have a problem with the BBC over its coverage of women being mistreated in Iraqi society. Obviously, it is a problem, and regardless of who covers it, it is, of course, something which is greatly important. However, the problem with the programme is that it seems to have purposefully missed out key aspects of the story here in Iraq. The way in which the film was styled seems to suggest that the Iraqi religious leadership has purposefully neglected Iraqi women, especially those most in need, and has also failed to police the practice of muta, or temporary marriage, both of which is actually not the case, as we've seen in our time here in Iraq.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
The long oppressed people of Bahrain have a date with destiny, and their democratic aspiration will eventually triumph over the repression of a ruthless and unrepresentative regime, says Kayhan International staff writer in an article published under the heading, "Is the repressive Al Khalifa minority regime nearing its end?" Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. We seem to be living in a topsy-turvy world, where realities are ignored and facts are disregarded, while forgeries, fabrications, and falsities circulate from the corridors of power in the capitals of the West to the pompous palaces of their unelected clients in the Arab world, with reverberations in the halls of the United Nations as well. One such center of corruption, repression, and perversion in our own region is the Persian Gulf statelets of Bahrain, which, while brutally suppressing the vast majority of the local population, hosts the U.S. Fifth Fleet in the hope of averting the inevitable, that is, the imminent end of the Al Khalifa minority regime of pirate origin. Now the tyrannical Sheikh Hamad, who since 2010 likes to call himself king, a title never used by his sire since their occupation of Bahrain in the early 19th century, has entered into an unnatural alliance with the illegal Zionist entity in the vain hope of survival. Though the Zionist premier Naftali Bennett visited Manama last February and spoke bombastic words of support for the Sheikh, he was not able to calm down the paranoia of his host about the Islamic Republic of Iran,
whose principal policy of defending the rights of the oppressed people all over the world is making Hamad and his ilk increase their brutalities against the people of Bahrain. Even the Sheikh American overlords are beginning to admit that. The Al Khalifa regime, in response to these fears, has imposed repression at home. According to statistics released by human rights bodies, in the last decade, death sentences have risen by 600%, and the political opposition has been thrown behind bars. Some 1,400 political prisoners are incarcerated in a single prison. The right of prisoners to weekly video calls with family members has been suspended in an arbitrary manner, and torture allegations are routine. Bahrain ranked 168 out of 180 countries on the 2021 World Press Freedom Index, compiled by Reporters Without Borders, and it was the 144 out of 167 countries in the Economist Intelligence Unit's Democracy Index. Freedom House gave Bahrain miserable rankings in 2020 in political rights and internet freedom. Plus, reports are rife in the Western media that with Britain's connivance, the minority regime is subjecting underage children to imprisonment and threatening them with rape. At the same time, the Zionist technology is being used to spy on not just the dissidents, but on ordinary citizens by eavesdropping on their phone conversations, which is indicative of the extreme fear in which the Al Khalifa regime is engulfed. It is clear that neither the US nor the Zionists can prolong the survival of such a shaky and savage regime that sooner or later will be a thing of the past. The long-oppressed people of Bahrain have a date with destiny, and their democratic aspiration will eventually triumph over the repression of a ruthless and unrepresentative regime. Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing National Bird, directed by German filmmaker Sonja Kennebeck. And joining me in this episode are Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and many other outlets. And beside him, we have Dan Glazebrook, who's a journalist, political analyst, and author of the book Divide and Ruin, The West's Imperial Strategy in an Age of Crisis. Now, National Bird follows the harrowing journey of three US military veteran whistleblowers determined to break the silence surrounding the US's secret drone war. Tortured by guilt for their participation in the killing of faceless so-called suspects abroad, and despite the threat of being prosecuted, these three veterans offer an unprecedented look inside this secret program to reveal the haunting cost of the US's global drone strikes.
You literally just kind of hover, and you wait until he walked out to the field to meet with some friends for something, and you'd blow him up. dropped a Hellfire missile on him. Maybe we killed our objective, maybe we killed a guy who we thought was our objective. You don't know.
When I first got into the military, I was thinking it was a force for good in the world. I thought I was going to be on the right side of history, and today I don't believe I was.
I still have a top secret clearance, so I have to be extraordinarily cautious about what I can and can't say on camera.
My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, and identify everything.
Adolescent near the rear of the SUV.
That's deceptive. You get the opinion that you're at 10,000 feet, you see this photograph. You know what's going on. You don't know what's going on. You know what you see in two dimensions.
You see someone die because you said it was okay to kill them.
It's too easy. They just embolden commanders.
But the party began.
Because there is no threat.
Oh, sweet target.
I mean, this could grow to get so out of control.
Somebody downstairs was knocking at the door, and immediately both people at the door shoved FBI badges in my face.
The Espionage Act is one of the most serious charges you can level against an American.
Then I'm probably going to get indicted and I'm probably going to get charged.
I lost part of my humanity working in the drone program. It's a secret program. I can't just go telling the public what it is. What I can tell you is that to me, it's frightening.
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Sonia Kennebec, the director, she won an award for this documentary with the Nation Institute. And she said in her award acceptance speech that she initially set out to make this documentary solely just about drones and drone warfare. But then it developed into something much more than this. Of course, we learn of the stories of the three characters in the documentary. And she wanted to focus also on the consequences of whistleblowing and espionage and all these sorts of issues. And Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, you can always tell there's something in the air, both literally and figuratively in this case, when filmmakers start making films about the same kind of thing. So in recent years, we've had three or four movies on the subjects of drones. We've had this, we've had a documentary called Drone, which is a slightly more arty and abstract version of this story. But we've also had feature films like Good Kill with Ethan Hawke as a drone pilot and Eye in the Sky, a British film with Alan Rickman and Helen Mirren. So there's clearly something going on that filmmakers, they want to be a part of this conversation. And I think part of the situation is that we are still all, we're all making our way through this moral maze at the moment. We're all dealing with the ramifications of drone technology. We're trying to figure out what the consequences are, the good points and the bad points. And I think filmmakers like Sonia Kennebec here, they all want to have a say in that conversation.
And of course, so as you said, there's been a resurgence in this topic of drone warfare and the moral obstacles around it. And we've had this documentary had Wynne Wenders as the executive producer, of course, is a multi-winning, award-winning German filmmaker. How much impact do you think he had in this documentary?
Well, he's one executive producer, and he, you know, Wynne Wenders in the past has had an interest in surveillance technology. He made a very interesting film at the end of the last century called The End of Violence, which is about surveillance technology in America as it was back then, and obviously things have moved on very rapidly from that. The other executive producer is Errol Morris, who is, you know, a revered documentarian and has made things like The Fog of War in the past. So he himself is also very interested in this subject matter. So it obviously helps a young up-and-coming filmmaker when you can get two great filmmakers, two revered filmmakers within the industry to put their names on the credit of the film. And, you know, it all ties in with some of the work they've done in the past.
And Dan, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on National Bird?
Well, I thought it was interesting, but to be honest, I find this quite often with films on this subject, the tendency to focus on the emotional turmoil of the operators and really the perpetrators. I find, to be honest, slightly distasteful, really, given that the primary victims, obviously, of drone warfare are the people getting blown up and getting their legs blown off and so on. And they do feature in the film, and they have quite an extended section in Afghanistan talking to the victims, but you never get the feeling that they get the same full kind of personhood ascribed to them by the filmmaker. You don't see this sort of rich emotional life that's depicted of the operators and the perpetrators, and I feel like that's actually is playing into the hands of the dehumanization that allows things like the drone program to exist. Because yes, Afghans are in the film, but they're really there just as victims who you know kind of walk around and then get bombed. There's no real feel of what it's like for them, what their lives are like. So I find it difficult.
I see your point, Dan, but one could argue that the role of whistleblowers and journalists, of course, shine a light on these issues, otherwise that would be ignored. And I think Sonia probably emphasizes this in the documentary.
Absolutely, and you know, that what they've done to come out against the program is commendable. But I think even to kind of do justice, if you like, to the operators depicted in the film themselves, you know, what turned them against what they're doing is that at some point they had a realization, my God, these are human beings that I'm killing. They're just like me or my mom or my neighbor. And I don't think that realization that's led to them being racked by guilt is fully given to us as a viewer. And I think that's problematic.
Well, that's a really interesting point. We'll have to pause there just for now.
I was an imagery analyst and a screener. My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, the live video, of course, and identify everything. Another remote duty station, you'd have the pilot, of course, who's flying the actual aircraft, and the sensor operator who is moving the camera around. They were the ones that actually pushed the button. I do not push the button. I just identify what necessitates a button pushing. We can't just bomb someone and fly away. We have to follow through. The bomb hit and wait for it to cool down a little bit, and then you can see, like, the body parts. You can identify, like, that could be the lower half of his body. And that could be a leg. And then sometimes you'll stick around and watch family come and get them, or like pick up the parts and put their family member in a blanket. And a couple people hold onto a corner of the blanket and carry them back to their compound.
So it's Heather Limber. So you really feel for her in this documentary. Indeed, the other characters also, but she seems to come across as the one most plagued and crippled by guilt for her role in the drone program. Mike, what do you make of how her character is portrayed?
Well, she's not a million miles away from the Ethan Hawke character in Good Kill, the feature film that came out a couple of years ago, in that, you know, she was very much in the room watching this footage come in. And the sense that I got from her watching this film is that it's very different from being a soldier on the ground. If you're a soldier on the ground, you know pretty much that you killed someone if you haven't killed someone. The sense that I get from her, the issues that she's working through are connected to the fact that nobody has told her who she's killed, how many people she's killed. This is hanging over her. And you get a sense of this issue bearing down on her. It's like she's got something over her head. And that is a very powerful thing.
And Dan, I know you say the true victims are, of course, the targets of the drone strikes. But in this documentary, you see Heather and the others almost come across as victims in their own right, and perhaps particularly connected to the US military's recruitment campaigns. I mean, it's sold off, as you see, as a glorious sort of career you could have, and that you're on the right side of history and justice. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, certainly. They are victims as well. They're, I mean, secondary victims, I would say, but certainly, I mean, they're recruited into it pretty much as children, and to talk about the majority of drone operators being 18 to 24, so they're recruited at 18, practically children, but they'll be kind of groomed effectively from 16, 17. If you think about the involvement of the Pentagon with the video games industry, they're really being groomed from the age of whenever they start playing video games, 8, 7, 6, into this role. So it is a form of institutional child abuse within America, you know, what America is doing to its own children, and here in this country in Britain as well, same thing. So, certainly, and of course they're sold, as you say, the idea of being on the right side of history, one of the people involved in the program said.
They have this real sense of moral righteousness, and that they set out to do the right thing.
Yeah.
They had good intentions at heart.
Exactly, but it is child abuse, and you see the you see the impact and the fact that they, you know, they're not even allowed to talk to therapists because the therapists don't have security clearance. So the other thing that they would want to discuss is classified, and so on. So absolutely, the treatment of them by the military is shocking. And you hear testimony from Heather in the film that her kind of commanding officers were constantly questioning her judgment. She was saying, I think there's women and children here and so on. And they're saying, are you sure? I don't think so. Let's fire anyway, and being overruled and so on. So yeah, absolutely. There's, you know, they are victims as well. I just don't think they're the primary victims.
That's a good point. And Mike, I just really quickly want to talk about the shots that are used in this documentary. We see a lot of aerial shots. And do you think the director did this intentionally to give the Western viewer the sense of what it's like to be watched? Because a lot of the shots are in US sort of suburban areas.
Yeah, I mean, the film sort of flips on its head halfway through, and we get a sense that the people who have been employed as watchers are now the watched. And you know, that is very much there in all those drone shots over American cities, American towns. I mean, drones have revolutionized the way movies in general have been made, because now it's much cheaper to do aerial shots rather than hiring big bulky crane equipment. You can just fly a plane or fly a drone above people's heads. So that has changed as well, and I think that's one of the reasons why we're seeing so many films on this subject. The technology, the form and the content are married in this respect.
I think one of the strengths of the documentary is it shows how barbaric and brutal drone strikes are. And Mike, if I could ask you, what did you make of this journey to Afghanistan and this story?
I liked it very much. I mean, we see so many documentaries that set out their case in the first hour and then spend the second hour driving home the same points over and over again. Here, I think you get a sense of a story developing in real time. There was a sense that this technology has been thrust upon us, and like I said, we're all negotiating our way through this moral maze. And when it does finally get to Afghanistan, you get a sense there from that clip, you know, the plane comes over, of just how normalized this kind of life has been. I mean, the fact it's called National Bird, you know, would suggest that the drone has now become part of the natural order of things, part of the landscape for so many people, in ways both good and terrifying.
That's a really interesting point. And Dan, if I could turn to you, would you agree with what Mike just said? What did you make of the journey to Afghanistan in this documentary?
Well, I was glad they included it, because about 40 minutes into the film, I thought, are we going to hear anything from any Afghans whatsoever? And they did spend an extended period of time in Afghanistan. But as I said, I still didn't feel really they came across fully as agents. They were still depicted as, okay, they were shown as suffering and as victims, but there's portrayed as only victims, just kind of passive recipients, really, of U.S. air power. There was no agency there. No narrative, no Afghan narrative was present, and there was no politics whatsoever in the film. And I think there's a real danger. The Glasgow Media Group carried a really interesting study out a few years ago on the Palestine-Israel conflict, and they found that a lot of journalists were quite sympathetic to the Palestinians, but they knew that they weren't really allowed in Western media to actually put forward a Palestinian narrative about resistance to occupation and so on. So instead of that, in place of that, they just paraded an endless parade of Palestinian suffering, but overlain with an Israeli narrative to justify it. Mm-hmm. And I think the danger by not giving any kind of Afghan narrative, we just see, okay, we see the Afghan suffering, but there's no narrative, there's no other side of the story. The danger is that you have the same thing with the Palestine-Israel conflict, which people have pity for the Palestinians, but the overall view in the West whenever Israel attacks is, well, it's a sort of necessary evil in the war against terrorism. It's terribly sad and we pity them, but it kind of has to be done. And I think there's a danger this film will have the same effect. People feel sorry for the Afghans, they'll pity them, but won't necessarily just see, oh, it's a shame these innocent bystanders die and so on, but that's kind of necessary.
Mike, so would you have liked to see more political context to this documentary?
There's certainly scope for a more comprehensive and possibly slightly drier documentary about drone technology and the politics of deployment. I mean, this is not a film about the systemic application of drone technology. It's not about the technological specifics of it. It is a human story, and those are the documentaries that tend to get sold at international marketplaces, play at festivals these days, because they're very easy to relate to. Mm-hmm. I still think we're in the early days of the early days of this technology, and there will be a more comprehensive documentary than the ones that we've seen so far. But in terms of a primer of how this affects both the watched and the watchers, I thought it was pretty solid.
Well, thank you for that point.
this is global. This is getting information anywhere at any time, shooting people from anywhere at any time, and it's not just one person sitting there with a little remote control, a little joystick, moving around a plane that's halfway across the world. That's not all there is. It's like borders don't matter anymore, and there's a huge system that spans the globe that can just suck up endless amounts of your life, your personal data. I mean, this could grow to get so out of control. And we're not the only ones that have this. This is going to be commonplace, if it's not already. It's a secret program. And what that means is that I can't just go shouting off the hilltops telling the public what it is. What I can tell you is that to me, one person who worked within this massive thing, it's frightening.
So, Mike, in the documentary, we hear from President Obama give a televised speech talking about the drone warfare operation. And he says how it operates in such a way to ensure minimal loss of life and that they're precise and surgical strikes. Of course, in the documentary, we learn that it isn't really that precise. And Daniel even says, one of the characters, that an element of guesswork is involved. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes, I mean, everyone does seem to be operating in some kind of grey area. I mean, we've seen from the clips that actually the images that the drones beam back to the operators in America are very fuzzy. I mean, there's a degree of ambiguity in those very images, never mind in the ethics of using this technology. And so what's interesting is what the film says about the way this technology has been sold to us. So it's clearly been sold to young army recruits as an exciting new development in the war on terror. And we've seen we see the adverts in the films that are all, they are like an advert for a computer game, as you say. But there's also a degree to which you think someone must have sold President Obama on this, that this is a new, clean way of killing, that you're killing, you're somehow keeping killing at arm's length, but you're still getting dirty hands. And I think this is something that all the people in the film are wrestling with.
Mm. Now, Dan, I think many people would be surprised to find that actually there were 10 times more strikes during President Obama's presidency than under George W. Bush, his predecessor. What do you make of Obama's role in the drone warfare?
Well, on the one hand, drone warfare is a kind of terrifying, dystopian kind of future brought into the present. But at the same time, that shouldn't blind us to the fact that it's driven by desperation on the part of the Western powers. They tried big ground operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the fallout in terms of blood and treasure was so great that they just are not in a position to do that again. Mm-hmm. The Colin Powell said the US Army is just about broken by Iraq. Mm-hmm. So they don't have that option. So when you say, it was Obama who sold Obama on this idea, well, the reality was he didn't, if he wanted to continue making war, and there's a whole systemic pressure to do so within the US government apparatus, mm-hmm. then the former options have been ruled out. Mm-hmm. It's no longer feasible to have these mass ground scale operations.
Like in the Vietnam War, over 50,000 US personnel died.
Right.
And this was one of the factors that led to that pressured the government to pull out.
Yeah.
But do you think if they had drones at the time that they would just have an endless war?
Well, it's an interesting question, isn't it? And quite feasibly, yeah, because it was the body bags coming home from Vietnam that drove the pressure to end the war. You're right. With mm-hmm. drones, there's no U.S. body bags. There's only Afghan body bags. Mm-hmm. And then there's obviously mental health fallout. Well, it's interesting that U.S. casualties do exist. Heather talked about three of her friends on the drone program committing suicide. Mm-hmm. But, of course, that doesn't have this generate the same headlines as a coffin coming home draped in a flag.
Mm. And a final say to you, Mike. Would you recommend this documentary?
I think it's certainly worth watching. I think, this is one of those technologies that is that has proliferated very quickly. And like I say, we're all still wrestling with the ramifications of it, the consequences of it. It's not a bad place to start. I still think there'll be a more comprehensive documentary some years down the line.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for your insights. And that's all the time we have for this episode of Duck Review. And thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Duck Review.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new study published in the journal Nature shows an association between brain size and structure among those infected by the COVID-19 virus. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by John Cooley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Study Shows COVID-19 Infection Linked to Brain Shrinkage and Cognitive Decline. Here's the story. A new study published in the journal Nature shows an association between brain size and structure among those infected by the COVID-19 virus. The study led by the Wellcome Center for Integrative Neuroimaging at the University of Oxford found strong evidence for brain-related abnormalities in COVID-19 patients who had had their brains scanned prior to their infection and then after they were either hospitalized with the virus or diagnosed as positive. Comparing images of brains taken before and after infection according to the study's abstract, we identified significant longitudinal effects when comparing the two groups, including greater reduction in gray matter thickness and tissue contrast in the orbitofrontal cortex and parapocamel gyrus, greater changes in markers of tissue damage in regions functionally connected to the primary olfactory cortex, and greater reduction in global brain size. Researchers also say the study revealed a cognitive decline in patients, even those who did not become sick enough to need hospitalization. Professor Naomi Allen, chief scientist at UK Biobank and a co-author of that study, said the study is the only study in the world to be able to demonstrate before versus after changes in the brain associated with SARS-CoV-2 infection. Collecting a second set of multi-organ imaging scans from some people who had been infected with SARS-CoV-2 and from others who had not been infected has generated a unique resource to enable scientists to understand how the virus affects internal organs. According to The Guardian's reporting on the study, compared with 384 uninfected control subjects, those who tested positive for COVID had greater overall brain shrinkage and more gray matter shrinkage, particularly in areas linked to smell. For example, those who had COVID lost an additional 1.8% of the parapocamel gyrus, a key region for smell, and an additional 0.8% of the cerebellum compared with control subjects. Disrupted signal processing in such areas may contribute to symptoms such as smell loss. Those who were infected also typically scored lower on a mental skills test than uninfected individuals. Lower scores were associated with a greater loss of brain tissue in the parts of the cerebellum involved in mental ability. Dr. Serena Spodich, who serves as chief of neurological infections and global neurology at Yale School of Medicine, but not involved in the study, said the findings are striking. Spodich told the New York Times, "To me, this is pretty convincing evidence that something changes in brains of this overall group of people with COVID." While potentially groundbreaking, the researchers involved said more must be done to understand the long-term impacts of COVID on the brain, including the impacts of more severe cases and the organ's ability to heal after recovery from the virus. Professor Guinel Dunant, lead author on the study, said she and her fellow researchers were in a unique position to look at changes that took place in the brain following mild as opposed to more moderate or severe SARS-CoV-2 infection. Despite the infection being mild for 96% of participants, we saw a greater loss of gray matter volume and greater tissue damage in the infected participants, on average 4.5 months after infection, she added. They also showed greater decline in their mental abilities to perform complex tasks, and this mental worsening was partly related to these brain abnormalities. All these negative effects were more marked at older ages. A key question for future brain imaging studies is to see if this brain tissue damage resolves over the longer term.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The world is closely watching the Russia-Ukraine conflict as it can potentially end in outcomes that would send shockwaves across the globe. Russia launched what it calls a special military operation to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. That came despite weeks of warnings from Western capitals that such a move would bring catastrophic results. The United States and its allies decided not to confront Russia directly and resorted to supporting Ukraine with intelligence and military hardware. They launch another war that isn't fought with bullets or rockets, but affects banks and financial institutions, an economic war. Washington and its allies have announced several rounds of sanctions on Russia, mostly targeting its banks and energy sector. The scrapping of the highly anticipated Nord Stream 2 pipeline project that would transfer Russian gas directly to Germany was among the measures. Moscow has already warned that it could cut its gas supplies to Germany via the Nord Stream 1 pipeline.
The implications of this event on the economy, the implications of this for the Russian economy, I don't think are quite as tragic as some of the Western press would like to have us believe, because I believe that the Russians have a great many more shock absorbers because they are less exposed than many of the Western capitalist economies.
The tensions risk escalating into a wider energy crisis in Europe, which has over the past year experienced shortages of fuel and price hikes. The military conflict and ensuing sanctions are already showing their effects, but not only on Russia. Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak said crude prices could surge to over $300 per barrel if the U.S. and European Union ban imports of oil from Russia. Oil prices have already spiked to close to $140 per barrel, the highest since the 2008 financial crisis. Western sanctions on Moscow, coupled with logistics turmoil, have also shaken markets for other commodities. U.S. wheat futures rose more than 7%, nearing an all-time high amid fears of supply chaos. European wheat has already hit record highs as deepening Western sanctions against Russia fueled concerns about exports from the Black Sea region. Russia is the world's biggest